My name is Josh Prager. I'm one of the founders of 20 Summers, and this is the second event of our third season. So thank you. Okay. Edith, so you are a personal hero of mine, and I will allow James to give you a more thorough and proper introduction. But there are very few people who change the lives of millions, and you have. And it was your clarity of vision and seeing something through and not minding the odds and just plunging ahead that made this happen. And very often, I've learned in my life as a journalist, it's not good to meet your heroes. They invariably disappoint. But from the moment you returned my email with exclamation points telling me that you had been here and you knew about the barn, my ego, I was thrilled. And you're such a gracious person. So thank you so much. Or living up to my expectations.
It's so such happy. A,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
And another person in that rarefied air in that very small category is James Lacine.
Yeah.
And James is an actor, a writer, the co-founder of co-founder of the Trevor Project, and so many other things. If you want to read more about him, it's on our website. He said, this is about Edie tonight. But just to tell you how special he is to us, he's our first repeat collaborator. So we're so excited to have you back. James, I think it might have been the first reading of your play, The Absolute Brightness of Leonard Peltke, which was here in the barn on this very stage. Actually, not this stage, just the new stage, but this very spot. And we're so absolutely thrilled to have you back. So thank you. Just the last thing to say, they will have a conversation of about 40 or so minutes, followed by questions. Thank you all so much for being here.
Hi, honey. No, we'll stay. I feel like to make an introduction of Edie for a hometown crowd is sort of unnecessary in the sense that we all know the incredible thing that she accomplished with her life. But I just want to say that for me personally, I'm already getting choked up. and we just started. Too soon. As the co-founder of the Trevor Project, which is a suicide prevention and crisis intervention lifeline for LGBT teens, which started 18 years ago, it was one of my desires that we would find a way to be able to create a link between generations of gay people. And that it was one of the things that I mourn and grieve, which is that I grew up without having heroes in my life. I didn't know them. I didn't know gay heroes. There were people I admired. But in my life, there were no gay people at all. And there were certainly no gay heroes. And when I always had this idea with the Trevor Project that it would be a way to be able to pass along our history in some way by just communicating one generation to the next. But I never took into consideration that there would be new heroes coming down the pike. It never occurred to me that people would come along and do extraordinary things. And I just have to say that in the time that I've been involved with the Trevor Project, nothing has had such a big impact to the young people as what Edie did. It was the first clarion call to young people that their love was acceptable and that they might have a life that included a full and rounded love life, including marriage. So, to me, it's such an incredible honor to be here. And I just want to add that the first time I did the show in New York, this solo show that I do, The Absolute Brightness of Leonard Peltke, I was doing it at Dixon Place. I came out onto the stage and Edie was sitting in the first row. And it was the first time I'm doing a show in New York and I am trying to remember my lines and I'm doing, And I'm like, that's Edie Windsor. Like, it was as if the gay guardian angels just like came down and she just landed there. And sitting there, like, she was my audience. So I'm just so happy to be here to sort of, you know, just to talk to you tonight and really just share this incredible space with you. And so I just want to start by really just bringing Thea into the room. You know, I think so much of this, there's so much attention on you because of what you've done, but it's so much, like, it's the two of you.
Yes, definitely.
And
definitely.
We were talking about this yesterday, because I said that the case was called Edie Windsor versus the Supreme Court, and which was actually not the case.
Yeah, it really listed Edie Windsor as speaking for Thea Squire, from Thea Squire's estate, as her executor, I think. Right.
And you know, I just thought, you know, one of the things I thought maybe it'd be good to sort of go back to the beginning and talk a little bit about meeting her,
yes,
and how important that was in terms of actually giving you a life in New York City.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's a big question, right?
Yeah, it is a very big question. Actually, I was convinced I came to New York to let myself be gay. Mm. And only I never met anyone. I mean, I met a lot of friends, but I never met anyone. And at one point I got a fellowship from IBM and to go any degree I wanted, any you know, and I went and I hated it and I wanted to go back to New York where the gay world was, regardless of whether I was succeeding in it or not. And I came back and I just worked all the time. And then I finally called up a friend of mine and said, if you know where the lesbians go, please take me. Okay. And my very best friend took me to a restaurant, which was not a gay restaurant, but on Friday nights, that's where the lesbians went. And someone brought Thea over to the table to introduce her. And that was the beginning of a different life for me. I was until then convinced that if you're gay and you don't meet someone when you're an undergraduate, forget it. Okay, it's never gonna be a possibility. So she changed all that. Is that enough for the moment? Well,
it's also, you know, I love your love story with her because it's also such a testament to your moxie and your determination to actually go after her and really wait for her, right?
Yes, okay. So it took about 2 years during which she lived with two different people at different, okay, one right after the other. And I thought, this is absolutely impossible and it will never happen in any way. And I don't even remember what changed it, actually. I might remember while we're talking. But anyway, we began to date 2 years after. We met in 1963. We began to date in 1965. Mm-hmm. And somewhere around 1967, the end of 1967, we became engaged. We married. And we stayed engaged for 40-some years.
And she gave you that pin that you're wearing tonight,
yes,
right?
Yes, okay. Oh, at the point, the engagement, we were driving out. It was the first time that we were going to be staying in the same place. And she asked if we could take a rental in the Hamptons. And I said, I can't afford that. I was just beginning to work in the computer business. And she said, okay, I'll take care of that. So, but it turned out she wanted a motorcycle. So I bought her a motorcycle, but she wanted a white motorcycle. And at the time, nobody made a decent motorcycle in white. So I had it custom painted. I mean, I really was involved.
And determined.
And it was the end of that summer that, we're driving out there and she said, what would happen if you became engaged? I was very close to the people that I worked with at IBM. We had a special group. They had taken a floor in the Time Life building for us, and we were writing some of the first software for the mainframes. And anyway, so she said, so, and I lied, always. I always lied about my life. And at some point when I met Thea and there started to be phone calls, okay, I said I was dating a guy named Willie. Willie turned out to be the name of the doll that Thea had brought with her when she came to this country during World War II, okay, when she was a kid. Okay. And at any rate, until our wedding was in the New York Times, and people were calling. We heard from wonderful things from everybody in our lives, but from the people I worked with, all I got was phone calls day in and day out with, "Edie, you lied to us." Yeah. Okay. Later, much later, Thea became crippled, in fact, quadriplegic, and she said, "You know, we've been so lucky, Edie. Okay, we've been in love all this time. We're still in love. We're just so lucky." I said, "No, you're lucky," and I was persistent. Okay.
It's a small detail, but I love that you kept Willie in the closet.
Oh, yes.
Right?
And then she asked me, she said, "So suppose you became engaged, would you wear a ring at work?" And I said no. They would want to know who is he and when do we meet him and stuff like that. And because we really were close friends, other than my lie. but she conned me into. By the time we got to the Hamptons, I said it would have to be a circle of diamonds. Okay. And that's how. That was it.
And in all those years that you worked at IBM, you never told those people?
Never. No. One or two people knew, okay, but...
But not discussed.
But, okay. Somebody I worked for, directly for, knew, and really was ferocious. If somebody gay came near my office, okay, she'd chase them. Okay, no way, no way, okay, you know. Okay.
Yeah, so, and... And then in 1977, Thea actually started to develop signs of
yes.
MS, right?
Yeah.
And so that was a long time.
Yeah,
right?
We had been together 13 years, because I remember someone called me saying, "I'm so sorry, I hear she's been diagnosed with MS." And I said, "Don't be sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. She's had this inconvenience." And we didn't think of it as sick at all, ever. But I said, if I had 13 years with this woman that I never expected to have in my life, and if that's all the joy I ever have, it's already, okay, no problem.
Yeah. But, and I think also your relationship with Thea is such an incredible example for people, like people who are disabled,
yes,
right?
Yes,
that
yes.
you can still have a full life and yes, you can still yeah. live and love,
well,
right?
And also, she also had a personality where she really reinvented herself every year. Mm. Okay, so as she became more disabled, she made an adjustment, okay, and kept going. Mm.
Was there any adjustment that was really difficult for her?
Must have been very difficult for her, but we never, first of all, we never both cried in the same room, okay, and we know we both cried, okay, until the only time we cried was she had gotten a really spectacular appointment in a psychiatric clinic where a psychologist is never the head, okay, the medical people are always ahead. And she was made the director of this thing. And so it was a very big deal. And I forget what the question was, okay.
was there ever a difficulty that she
yeah.
had?
Yeah, okay. And I said, "Can you imagine, look at what we've accomplished." Okay, each one of us, if we hadn't spent half our lives lying about who we were and hiding who we were. And she said, "Oh no, it's nothing." By the time we were done talking, we were both crying. The only time we both cried in the same room, okay. So, but later she developed a heart problem, which is really what ultimately she died of. Mm. But we never considered MS a disease, okay. It was like, it was a big inconvenience, it was a bigger inconvenience, but, okay.
Can you tell that story you told me yesterday about sex?
Okay.
I mean, you can say no.
I can't. Okay, actually...
I know you were sworn to not talk about sex during the trial.
During the trial.
But now it's okay, right?
Okay, great. Okay. Yeah. I, okay, the... Uh, A woman came to an architect who was an architect who specialized in making adjustments to handicaps. So she was, and she really supervised the making of ramps all over our country house and things like that. And but she also brought books with her, which were now out of print. Berkeley University had a program. They still have the program, in fact, I gather, where helping people to lead independent lives. Okay, and the goal always was to, okay, make your life as independent as possible and stay as alive and joyous as possible. And we took that very seriously. But one of the things that they said was, don't give up sex. And it said, if you have to get someone to lift one of you on top of the other, do that. Okay, do not give it up. So I mentioned that in the film, I think. Okay, and Tia said, well, we didn't do exactly that, but yes, there's no question we made large changes, and you know, she didn't use the word large. She said something like, you know, okay, extremely special,
creative.
Extremely whatever. Okay.
And then in 1997, you got married,
yeah.
Right? You went to Toronto.
Yes. We didn't get married until marriage was, okay, New York State.
Oh, right, that was the New York State law.
New York State had failed first, okay, in marriage. And then, but they had announced there had been another case to challenge whether or not New York accepted marriages, legal marriages from elsewhere. And the answer was yes, that New York State's constitution allowed for any legal marriage. So we went to Canada, but we went to Canada with this incredible guy, incredible activist, who introduced us to the judge who married us, who sent the two women to our house right before we were leaving for Canada to say that what he wanted was just get some words for me, you know, and take some pictures because I want to give them a little wedding present, just, you know, of a little film, just of the wedding. And when they left, they called him up and said, we want to do a documentary. And hence the film, Edie and Thea, Very Long Engagement, which is a wonderful film. And I guess most meaning to most young people, mm-hmm. Okay? I mean, all the other stuff is, you know, it doesn't matter, okay? Okay.
The love story
The fact
matters.
That the love story, yeah. Okay? That you could be disabled and have a full and happy and sex life, okay, was all very happy to people. The kids still love it.
I just want to go back to your civil union ceremony because it's just another example of how persistent you are.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't civil union.
Domestic partnership.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. And then suddenly New York State had domestic partnership, which had absolutely no rights unless you happened to work for the state. And I remember my sister asking me, you know, what it meant. And I said, I'm afraid the only difference I think it meant is I now have to pay New York City tax. Okay.
Okay. But went the first day. You were like number 8,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yes, yeah. Okay. Well, by then I was very active also, and everybody, we planned to be married at City Hall, even though we knew we would be rejected, kind of thing for that. But New York City indeed said, okay, you could have this thing, okay. And so we indeed have a certificate for, you know, partners, whatever it was, with absolutely no rights unless you worked for the city directly.
Mm. Yeah. And did it change anything in your relationship, having?
I liked having it.
But,
you know, it's symbolic.
And you were determined to get married, from that time, from early on, right?
I don't really know. I'll tell you, but starting with the first marriages in Massachusetts, Mary Bonanno's cases, okay, when we knew it was a possibility. Yes, I then started working. I was a marriage ambassador for Empire State Pride Agenda. Mm. I belonged to every marriage organization going, everybody fighting for it. I appeared a lot of the times with people going in knowing that they'd be refused. We would have a day when everybody is in line going into the clerk, and and asking to get married, and I was always there as a witness. I was there as a witness, and they would say, no, you can't have it. And I would say, well, but I'm here to witness it. You can't say that you can't have it, okay? And then we would, okay, and that would go on, okay. And month after month, some of this kind of stuff would happen. So we were very active trying.
Crying.
Yeah, I also turned out I had a great reputation for handing out, flyers. I would find a way.
Why am I not surprised?
If there was a park that was considered a good place to try it, okay, I would go out and I would always start. I would never say, you know, would you sign this or would you believe in this? I would say, I have a problem with personal rights, okay, and would you help me, okay? And so you would get people would pay more attention a little bit, okay. And then I would say, you know, I'd like to just give you this piece of paper. I'd like you to take it home and read it and think about it, okay? And I never really said what it was about, okay? But people took it, and some people read it on the spot, and okay, I didn't know this was a problem, kind of thing. So it was very good. I then had a list of every person with ability in the city and the state. Okay, to affect anything, and I had all the phone numbers. So if we were doing a march over the Brooklyn Bridge, so we would have 300 people doing this march. I would make sure that everybody had a list of all of the people that they could call on to turn on into our side, including. I gave one to a woman who was on the city council. Okay. And she said, it's okay, I know them, okay.
And I think it was one of the things that really surprised me, and I didn't know when I was sort of doing some research about, like, interviewing you, was what an activist you were before this whole thing happened. It wasn't like this was the first time at the rodeo. Yeah. You really...
No, I had a SAGE Lifetime Achievement Award a year before we actually, you know, even mentioned that we were going to do a case.
And you introduced computers to the LGBT Center in New York City,
right?
No,
I didn't really introduce it.
Were you a part of that?
They had some young people who had studied and wrote. They were trying to just computerize their mailing list to start. Nobody had that yet, and they were having trouble. So I went. I read the book. I didn't want to do it. I thought this was software with bugs, and why do I have to even get near it? Kind of and. Anyhow, but I did, and there were indeed, there were 8 serious bugs. These kids who were all new at this had no idea that you can find out where that's happening, and somebody didn't make a change. I belonged to a bunch of users groups, and at the time, that's the only, there were no books, there was nothing to help you except the users groups, and I went into the users group with my list. I think it was 20. Ultimately, it was 20 bugs, what turned out, okay, is one. I could go up and down a hallway and say, "Could you do this?" And people would say, "Well, could you get me machine time today?" And I said, "Oh my God, nobody's paying attention to all this talent who could be helping." Mm-hmm. But also somebody in that users group, I described the problems, and she shoved across a book, that a self-published book at the time, with the 20 bugs in whatever the hell the name of that thing was, and the workarounds. So I came back and I was a heroine, right? I followed exactly what the book said, and we got it working. But then I did a number of gay groups, which they still did not have anything on a computer. And I remember also giving people machines as I outgrew them. Mm. But I had one of those PCs with two 5-inch disks, okay, and that's all. One had the software, and the other one had your data to get.
Did you ever tell any of these people that they were helping the LGBT Center, or that they were helping these?
No. No.
Well, thank you for giving them the opportunity to help.
Yeah, okay, yeah, okay, yeah. No, but okay. I remember somebody in one of the groups said to me, you know, so-and-so outed you. And I said, if that particular person outed me, it must have been for my benefit. Which it was. It was. Okay.
So aside from the challenges of Thea's physical disability, were there other challenges just for the two of you as a couple in terms of the world, of being sort of not married in the world?
No, not really. Mm. Not really. Okay. One, we were very much in love. Two, we were very sophisticated. Mm. When we went on vacations, we met as many straight couples as we met gay couples, okay, and always had there was no problem. Everybody knew who we were with each other, but, you know, we just lived. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a happy story.
Yeah.
Then, of course, Thea passed away in 2009,
yes.
Right? And it wasn't that long afterwards that the film came out, right? Isn't that the first thing that...
No, yes. Well, the film was actually finished, was in being edited, okay? It was about the eighth edit and very close to the end. And she kept saying she wanted to see it. And they kept saying, the filmmakers kept saying, we want to wait till you see it in the theater, mm. Okay? And of course, she died never having seen it. So when the same thing happened with me, not very long after, and I said, oh, I know what happened is, at some point they had dropped off a disc. I was in the hospital after Thea died. I had a heart attack, called broken heart symptom, a very light heart attack. There were really a lot of problems, and I ended up very, very sick. Okay? And then I came home from the hospital, and a friend of mine was bringing me a disc every Saturday night and dinner, okay? And I went to put in the film, and there was already a film in my machine, and I played it, and it was Thea saying our marriage rites.
Whoa. Okay?
And I fell apart completely. Mm-hmm. And I said to them, you do not want this to happen publicly. You know, you have to let me see that film before it's out.
Yeah.
So they did. They borrowed a studio and showed me the film.
Were you by yourself, or did you have people
No, they were, the filmmakers were there, and the guy whose studio it was in, you know, that's all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was that like to see that at that point in your...
It was incredibly moving, and indeed I cried a lot. Mm. But it also, by then, I also was thrilled with it. You have to picture if you're aging, and really aging, and there's, you can turn on this thing and somebody is saying, she never changed. She's exactly like she was when I met her. I mean, come on, you know, okay.
Yeah.
That film was everything, okay. There's a point in there where, okay, I felt when she did die, she had one working arm, and so she could run her computer and she could run her wheelchair, and she still saw patients. Okay, nothing. She had nothing above the neck, no problems. And she had the day she died. I realized, oh my God! And I went to look, and she was living home by then, and with hospice coming in regularly. And I went to look at her book, and I thought, oh, there's two people coming in 2 hours. Okay, so I had to make those phone calls. She always worked. She was always social. She was always okay. I mean, all the brain was there always. So it's very hard to say. Okay, when she did die, it was from the heart thing, and it's the first time that she had an angina attack, and it wasn't ending. And I looked for I always had a big sign up with the hospice phone number. And it wasn't there. And I yelled out, for the aide was in another room, and I yelled out, where is the hospice phone number? And she said, Evie, I know it. She said, the last thing she said to me was the number which I dialed. Okay, and he was gone. But my feeling was, thank God, she didn't have time to be scared. She didn't have time to, she had no pain. Yeah.
And also you were there.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And, So, And then there's, in the film again, there's a moment in the summer before she died when she said no, she did not want to have open heart surgery for this valve thing. And she said, look, you know, if I don't move for 2 weeks, I lose muscle. Mm-hmm. It's a long, you know, it'll be a very long recovery, and there won't be any me left. So we called up the doctor and asked if we could have more, if there was anything additional. And I had her, I said, you get on this phone now and make sure she understands I'm not trying to, you know, okay, that's what you want. And the doctor said, no, okay. And she said, okay, but then we'll manage as we are. And it's so hard to say how she was about it at that point. Mm. She got out of the pool, where she could move in the pool, she could move arms that she couldn't move outside the pool, and her legs by then were gone. We would swim with me holding her legs up. Okay.
It's actually one of the most beautiful things in that film, which I'm sure many of you have seen, which is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Those scenes in the pool, they're so...
And she got out of the pool, and she's looking into the camera, and she said, And I had my summer, and I'm having it now. Mm. And I thought, okay, everything we did was right. Okay, it was really right. So that's it.
So moving on to the case.
Yeah.
So when was the first moment that you knew that you were going to do this? Or that you thought, I have to do this?
Well, the film was being, I was traveling with a, I got out of the hospital and I said to the doctor, send me home. I don't care if you're sending me home to die. Okay, I can't imagine yet how I'm going to figure out my life. I had a good life and, you know, just send me home, please. Anyhow, I went home and I was about to go home, though. The last day I was in the hospital, one of the filmmakers was there. She came every day with a different person who was editing, by the way, until I could meet the people who were editing. And she had gotten an email from the San Francisco Gay Film Festival, who had seen their previous work, and it just said, can you be ready by June? And she said to me, Edie, could we be ready by June? And I said, yes, absolutely. Okay, up and at 'em. Okay. We traveled then throughout the United States and Europe, okay, showing the film.
This was like the year after Thea died.
Yes,
you were really on the road with that film. That's amazing.
Yeah. And of course, everywhere, okay, people were meeting my person. Okay, mm. The film is full of her. So I kind of loved it.
Yeah.
It wasn't a strange world at all. Mm. That's about it.
Yeah. And then when was the moment that you thought that you were going to actually...
Oh, I got... Because we didn't have a legal marriage, the federal government altogether, the federal government did not, it really wasn't just New York, that was everywhere. Federal government did not acknowledge our marriages. And therefore, even though you're legally married in your state, you still had to pay estate taxes, which if her name had been Thea instead of Thea, okay, you wouldn't have had to pay. And I was indignant enough to at least, I went around to the gay organizations with the film saying I have a documented marriage. And I got no, the response was it's the wrong time for the movement. And then Brendan Fay, the same man who did all the other stuff, was indignant, called the man who was in the business of placing legal people. Okay, And that guy called me and said, did I tell this already? No, I didn't.
No.
Okay.
No.
The guy said...
No, they want to know.
Okay. Okay. The guy said, look, Brendan gave me your phone number. Is that all right? And I said, Brendan could do anything. Okay, you know, so far he's only been this joy in my life, kind of. And he said, I know a few lawyers who might be interested in your case. Because I walked around with that film saying, I have a documented marriage, damn it, somebody pay attention. And they didn't, okay, but Brendan did. Okay. Anyhow, the next day, Robbie Kaplan walked into my house. First she called me and I said, I can't talk on the phone, I don't hear well enough. Okay, so, and she lived 3 blocks away, so she came over. And And only later, as her book, which is here, I gather.
Yeah, and it's an amazing book, by the way. I'm plugging the book, which is called Then Comes Marriage.
Yeah.
It's by Roberta Kaplan, who was the lawyer for the case. It's an incredible, incredible read. Because, you know, one of the things I think, at least for me, is that I only knew about the case when it was over, really. Yeah. I mean, we only knew like when it was celebrated and it was done and it was decided, but there are so many amazing miracles that made this case happen. So many tiny little mystical connections that happened throughout this case. And you read this book, which is written by a lawyer, but it has such a mystical quality to it.
Yes, it's given,
and especially it's right from the start when she met you.
No question.
Right, she came over to your house and you have to tell what happened.
Okay, well. But it's a little more than that even. The book has two chapters on me, but they're all things that were part of the case. Nobody knew anything about the lawyer, except she's a lawyer, okay, for a big firm. Okay. And she wrote her story. So it's the first time she told the world she was gay. It's the first time there are all kinds that she told her story. Part of her story was that she had seen Thea. In her office, and it was that and she described she did not come out until she was in her third year of law school, and then I think that's accurate, mm-hmm. right? And it was the day of the big parade in New York for Gay Pride, and her parents came to visit coincidentally that day, and they had to cross the parade. And her mother walked in saying, "That is so disgusting. What are they proud of? My God, they ought to be ashamed, they ought to be hiding." Okay, and her mother banged her head. Okay, her mother kept saying this, Robbie kept saying, "Please, Mom, no more." And finally her mother said, "What's the matter with you, are you gay?" And she said, "Yes." Okay. Okay. And her mother went, banged her head against the wall. Okay. So Robbie felt there's no going to be no way to live. Okay. And this is all in the book. Okay. And again, it thrilled me. I had no idea she was going to do that when I read the first thing. And then she told that she was depressed. She said, "There's no life. You can't have a family." Okay. With that, she asked about, did anybody know a psychologist or a psychiatrist who was interested in gay issues, and people recommended Thea. She saw Thea twice, during which, she described her depression and what was causing it, or what had caused it, but now it was total. And Thea said, she never talked about herself to patients. And she said, "Let me tell you about me and Edie Windsor." Okay, and then she described me, a funny description, which Robbie described. She expected to see, some guy with a whole bunch of pencils that's sticking through his pocket. And stuff, okay?
Some techie, right?
And that's all in the book, the only reason I tell it.
So the day that she came over to visit you, to meet you for the first time, she walked into that apartment where Thea was actually...
Once Thea was really quadriplegic, we turned the living room into her office, and she had a waiting room there and stuff. Anyhow,
Did she tell you that day?
That day, I didn't know it. I didn't know a lot of it until I saw... Wow. See, I saw the publisher's copy of the book before it was going to press, really, okay? Because we always edited each other anyhow, and certainly she wanted me to make sure that I had that everything about me was what I felt was true.
But you decided that she was going to be the lawyer for you day, right?
First I said, "What would it cost me?" And she said, "Okay." Okay, I was complete pro bono all for 3.5 years.
Wow.
Okay, and her company, her generally okay from their first day, Paul Weiss. Part of their mission was to always be diverse in their own employees and in their customers, and to stick with it. It's also during that period, if you looked up lawyers. Okay, all firms were either all Italian or all Jewish or all whatever. Okay, they were two guys, one Catholic and one Jewish, who founded it and went for this whole thing. Mm. Uh, I got to learn a lot about it later because they were getting an award from one of the gay organizations, and I got to introduce the guy who was going to accept the award.
And did you tell Roberta that day that you were going
to... Yeah, well, first she said, I want you to go. She sent me to my computer to read about the case, a case that she had done for New York State and lost. Okay, and then she said, okay, how do you feel? Okay, when I read it, she said, are you still interested? And I said, I think the brief was brilliant, and I think it was very gutsy of you to tell me it was a case you lost. Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah, I trust you. Yes, I do want to do it. And that's, yes, we decided that day. She says within 5 minutes, with maybe 15, but that's all.
Yeah.
Okay, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And then you were together, you actually, for the next, what, three and a half?
I can't tell, it's either 2.5 or 3 and a half years. I keep getting it confused.
But it was a really good partnership, right?
I mean, extremely good partnership.
And really real. I mean, you became very close to her family and her son, right?
Well, I fell in love with her son, for one. And I was his best friend for a while while he was 6 years old, 7 years old, 8 years old. Somewhere in there, around age 9, he met a girl his age. and I stopped being his best friend. Okay. We stayed friends, and he was a late reader because he had a what's the damn thing that's where people have trouble?
Dyslexia?
Yeah. Okay. So he was having difficulty reading, and I read to him a lot. And so then the first thing that happened is he complained if his mother read to him, or one of his mothers read to him, and said, you know, we have to stop now because it's bedtime. And he said, Edie never stops. She finishes the book. Okay. And Robbie reports all this, right? The other thing that happened is he began to read, and he was reading to me, and just beginning really, and he was doing extremely well, but he hit a word that he couldn't read, and he threw himself on the couch, right? And I said, no, okay, we're gonna do the, wouldn't you read with me? Okay, and let's do it again, and you read as more than you're comfortable, and then just nudge me if you want me to take over, and then nudge me again when you wanna take over. Mm-hmm. So we did that through a whole book, and then, And I appeared one day, and he came, walked in with a book, and he said, I want to read this to you. And he's really, you know, he was always articulate. He had an incredible vocabulary. And so it was the first time he read a whole book to somebody. Mm, okay.
Wow,
and it was great.
And it was you.
Yeah. And it made a huge bond with the whole family. Mm. I mean, there was a point after the decision when Robbie wrote it, was making a speech, and she asked me to read it. She was preparing for some law group, but it was well after the decision, and had my ex-husband's name in it. And I said, it's a great thing, but get rid of his name, please. I don't know if his wife knows he was ever married. I don't know if his kids know, and she wouldn't do it. And I didn't speak to her, like, for a month. And her partner, her spouse, okay, called me up and said, Jacob and I would like to come for a play date. Could we do that? And I said, yes, please, okay. Because I was worried about him, you know, it's the way to treat a kid, to cut out, kind of, okay. And that's how Robbie and I became family again, okay.
Mm, through him.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel like there's so many, I can't believe the time, because we haven't even really gotten into the case, but I just thought maybe it might be a good idea to open it up to the audience, and maybe they could ask some questions.
Sure,
right?
Absolutely.
So it's up to you.
Edie, you have a great story about Thea's penchant for the wallpaper in the New York apartment.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So I'm just going to repeat the question, which is that Edie has a great story about the pension check as wallpaper.
Wallpaper. Okay. Okay. So we went to pick. Oh, it wasn't wallpaper. It was a shower curtain. We went to pick a shower curtain, and I picked a floor with flowers. And she said, no, no, it has to, wallpapers have to have straight lines like water. Okay. And I thought, well, okay. And she won. I mean, I said, you know, she really feels this strongly, okay. And afterwards, she said, I feel like a damn fool. And let's, how about every time there's something like that where I'm absolutely sure, okay, how about we take the opposite? And we did that till a day when we were at a place where people were asking for volunteers to house strangers who were coming to town, strange gay people, primarily strange gay guys, in fact, who were coming to town for a conference, and asking for volunteers for this, and we're standing in line to sign up. And somewhere about 10th in line, she banged me on the shoulder and she said, you know what, it's time to change that, and if I think something strongly, we're going to do it. Okay, we're not going to take the opposite. Mm-hmm. And she said, we're not going to do this. We're going to have a little line.
Okay. Anybody have a question? Yeah, back there in the back.
You have to translate for me.
So she just says that she hopes you have she hopes you have plans for your brooch, like what's going to become of it, along with the story.
Yeah.
With hundreds of years to come.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm really not sure.
Okay. And someone telling the story in brass.
Yeah. She said that you should find some place for 100 years to come.
Yeah.
Like the
a lot of my stuff will go into archives. Okay, and I'm choosing between two places and hoping that they'll cooperate and both take stuff. But I would probably go with that. Unless I have a friend who's dying to have it, in which case, that'll come first.
I'm sure there are lots of hands will be going up in this very room.
Yeah, right there
in front, yeah.
Thank you, first of all. You're obviously a pioneer in more than just in the case. You were a software developer and worked for IBM in the early 1960s. You must have been one of the few, if the only woman at the time.
In 1987, I was a huge corporation that included all of the software companies at that time, all of the computer companies, and we were named, 12 of us were named pioneers in operating systems. Today, I am a lousy end user, probably one of the worst, okay.
What do you think made you such, be the first in so many things? What do you think in your background, or your childhood, or your family made you that way?
What do you think it was in your background or your past that made you such a good programmer early on? What do you think is in your personality or in your past that made you such a pioneer in so many things? Is that good?
Yes.
We'll do it together.
I just worked hard at things I loved. Okay. Or recently, I was talking to a group called Lesbians Who Tech. And they were asking, you know, what my particular talents were. And I said, the truth is my biggest talent was probably that I love talent. And I took incredibly good care of people who worked for me and encouraged them and helped them to grow and be. Mm-hmm. Okay. I loved it. Originally I used to say writing a program is like reading a great mystery. Okay, you have to get to the end. You have a definite, you know, goal. Okay, it's got to do this thing or it doesn't. And they talk now about the Times did a thing on why do programmers work in the middle of the night, and they did a whole page on it. And what they were pointing out is that because they can't stand interruption. Okay, it's too, okay. And I have that in spades. I mean, it's terrible, you know. Okay. If you want to see me on a given day when I'm doing something that takes concentration, Either it has to be at 8 o'clock in the morning so that I'm free by 9 to then have the whole day, or maybe at the end of the day, but I can't risk it. I can't commit it because it may not be finished.
Okay, the risk of interrupting you.
Yeah.
anybody have a question?
I don't have a question, but I wanted to just say something. Edie, you know I come from a large family, and there's a lot of gay people in my family. And I just want to thank you, because after you made this available for us, four of us siblings all got married. And I have a brother that had been with someone for 37 years or something like that, got married. Katie and I got married. And then my younger brother got married, and my younger sister got married. And so and we're a good Catholic family. This was, just amazing, and I want to just say thank you.
Yeah. Oh, you're quite welcome. Very welcome.
I have a question. It's a little, I hope it's not too personal, but just towards the end of the conversation, you mentioned that your husband was mentioned in the book, an ex-husband. And in the story, that sort of, so I'm curious about that at that time, getting married was what you were supposed to do, so I'm guessing that that's what you did. And then after that, you wanted to go find where the gay people were.
Now, I can barely hear, but he's got to repeat it.
Okay. So she was just asking about about your husband.
Yeah.
And about leaving him, going to New York.
I was
new information.
I married my big brother's best friend. I had a case on him when I was, they were 4 years older than me. And I had a case on him from when I was like 11 years old. Okay, I really worshiped this guy. And all of a sudden the war ended and they all got out of the army and into college the same year that I was starting college. Okay, and he and I, were in love, no question, okay. But then I met, we became engaged, and then I met the first woman that I fell in love with. Mm-hmm. And I tried to get over it. I broke our engagement. Nevertheless, he used to call every 6 months or so. He said, what are we doing Saturday night? Or what are we doing New Year's? And I always saw him, no question. And so it became what I felt was the only way to live, plus I thought I could do it, because I did love him, tremendous guy. And we were married for a year, close to a year, and if I was out, we were out on the street, and if there were two women together, I was so jealous, And I had never been out on a Saturday night with a woman. I always dated boys, And I just couldn't bear it. And I finally said to him, honey, you deserve more. And I need something else. And I told him. Okay. We split then. I didn't hear from him again until my 70th birthday when he called to say, I still love you. Okay. Then I had problems with like Robbie wanted to put his name in the thing, and I said, you don't need it. It's not relevant to what you're trying to do, and she wouldn't change it at the time. Okay? And I felt very strongly about it. The woman who did the big article in the New Yorker, had it in there, and she had to fight with her editor to get it out. And I left. I let her late. I didn't even nag her about the first sentence. Which you can't even repeat in nice, because I said, well, it is a come on to the story and what have you. But she had a fight with her editor, who said a good reporter doesn't do that. And finally she won, so his name was not in that. A year later, I don't even know how much later, I was dressed to go to a party. I had on my coat and the phone rang and I picked it up and someone was kind of stuttering a little. And I said, please just tell me who this is. I'm on my way out the door. And she said, I'm Saul's widow. And I said, give me a minute to take off my coat, okay? And we talked for about 40 minutes. And then we arranged to see each other. She came and visited me for a couple of days. Then Temple University was honoring me. And she showed up not only with herself, but with her daughter and a granddaughter. And she said, we all knew all about you. He always loved you and he always talked about you, okay? So we all knew about you, kind of. So that's the story of it, okay? Yeah. He was, I wrote about him, you know, when I wrote about him in the case, I said any straight woman would adore this man, okay? He's, you know, handsome and sweet and smart and, you know, I can't tell you, okay?
You know, it's one of the things that I really just love about you and your story is your insistence on living with love.
Yeah.
Like that you were so determined, like to really find real love.
Yeah.
Like you weren't able to settle for anything less than the real thing.
Yeah. I have to tell you, my mother's kids could do no wrong. Okay. And they did a lot of wrong. Okay, no way. Okay.
Maybe that's the answer to your question back there about like how do you become a pioneer? You just have a mother that thinks you do no wrong.
Edie, tell the story about when you won the case.
Good.
When you won the case, where were you and where did you hear about it and how did you feel and what did you do?
So when you won the case, where were you? How did you feel, and what did you do?
Well, I hate to tell you, but this, you know, the decision day can be originally one of 2 days in a week, and you never know which week it's going to be. Well, by June, we knew it was going to be sometime during the month of June that they were not going to hold over. And then we're going to go to D.C. and, like, hole up, right? Or we go and come back each week when it didn't happen. And I was really exhausted, and I said, I can't do it. And the Gay Center in New York has always been extremely helpful and what have you. And they had set up for a case of emergency. They had TV set up, they had everything set up. And I said, I'll go to the center, I'll talk to them now and tell them, okay, that what I need to be able to see and I will do it. And I'll make sure that, you know, that I'll be able to show to them to my colleagues and in D.C. And what happened is my lawyer called me 2 days later and said, we're all going to stay in New York. And we did. So we got the news sitting in Robbie's dining room, which had a big long table, okay, and we're all sitting around it. And each of us had a laptop on and we were watching SCOTUS blog. I don't know if you guys, SCOTUS is the Supreme Court, and SCOTUS blog is where you get the information if you're not in that room hearing it. That's the fastest you're going to get the information, okay, at all, okay? Nobody can come in and out even. And what they have is runners. There's this group that does SCOTUS blog.
Sounds ancient.
Okay, yeah, okay. Okay, they have runners they have one seat reserved for that runner. And I met a young guy, a delicious young guy, who had an ad running after everything with there's a one of the known gay women on TV, and it was dear gay woman, okay, please help me, I need to find Dee Dee. Okay, and I saw it and I called him up, okay, and he came to visit me, okay, then he brought his mother to come visit me, and a perfectly wonderful kid. What happened is he's a school teacher, he missed the open arguments, okay, and the decision decided on a day when there was no school. So he came very early, and he was the first person there that was not a reporter waiting, okay, and the SCOTUS blog people. So first the reporters were asking him questions, and then the SCOTUS blog asked him if he would like to be their runner.
Oh my gosh.
And I believe he stayed their runner then for a long time. Okay, but so that's who he was, and he was, and they had him dressed. He had to wear their T-shirt and shorts, and he looked like he was running in his underwear. Okay, right, but he ran out of that. Okay, and we all got the news. From him, he reported immediately to the SCOTUS blog guy sitting there, and it was on all our TVs before it was announced anywhere.
So we
were there, okay. We then went to the center to do our, what do you call it?
But wait, what happened?
Press thing.
Wait, go back.
We won.
I know, but he was like, all right. Get your coat, we're going to the center. Like, what, I mean, like, did you cry? Like,
Robbie's wife cried something fierce. She was the only person sitting at the table who had a little kid. Oh. Okay? And her thing is, her little kid's life is saved by, okay? Yeah. Which a lot of people with little kids felt, mm-hmm. okay, very strongly that, okay, their kid does not have to grow up in a, you know, in a tainted world, kind mm-hmm. of. No, that was it. Okay, then they said they had sent. Okay, I always had people from Paul Weiss, from Robbie's company. Okay, who had agendas. They would drive me around on the agendas, and they had me going to Robbie's offices so that I would be there to answer questions from reporters on the phone, and friends of mine who from all my marriage equality groups. Okay, wanted to do a rally outside of, what's the name of the bar?
Stonewall
yep. Bar, okay. And I said, what time do you want me to speak? Oh, and I know there's a kid who's got this list for me, okay, and who's going to pick me up and take me. And I said, what time do you want to see me? And, everybody kept saying, you have to have security. And I kept saying, I don't need security. No gay group is going to hurt me. Okay. And anyhow, by then I had three cops of my own. Okay.
Oh, three nice. Nice for you.
Exquisite police people. Okay. That's a different story. But my cops were all, okay. So I said, okay, I'm going to come by car. Okay, make sure there's space for me to pull up in front of the thing. When I open the door, I want pick 10 guys, okay, to surround me in case they're right and I need security, okay, and I want something to stand on, somebody to help me get up on it, and a microphone. So that was our plan, and we were all ready for it. They called in all over the place to make sure they had everybody in place, And anyhow, when Robbie realized what was going on, she said, we'll all go. So all the news kept talked about the Paul Weiss car coming down 7th Avenue, I think, right? And what happened actually was our car coming down. They were following us, okay, because we were all going the same place. But people on the street, okay, I mean, it would be a couple standing on the street and would see me, okay, in this car and would start to cry, okay. I mean, it was an amazing experience, but in all the publicity shows, the Paul Weiss cars came down, okay, this happened. Anyhow, it was grand. It was absolutely grand, and my police were there. My police started, okay, the first time I got an award in one of the gay groups, a young man came up to me and said, gave me his card, and he said, I think he was a sergeant at the time, and he said, I'd like to help you, and I want you, just wait a minute, let me get my boss, I want her to hear what I'm saying, okay, and she came over, and he said, I just want you to know if you feel harassed in any way, okay, my part of my job is to do this kind of thing, and okay, my whole precinct, well, here's my card, my precinct, the whole precinct will know who you are and will know to respond immediately. And he said, don't be embarrassed, don't be scared that you might be wrong if you have any sense of, you know, that anybody is pushing you in any way. Okay, just call. And then he became my cop. If I went to stand on a corner to watch something, he would be there, okay. It was amazing and wonderful. And then his partner joined them. Then there were two of them. And then ultimately...
Partner?
Oh, yeah, ultimately there were three. No, they're just, yeah. None of them were gay, okay.
There just was, checking.
Yeah, they were, yeah. They were
you know, in, and a good cop.
Yes, they were in this, they were in, you know, this group whose job it was really to protect the, okay, all together. But they were mine, no question. And wherever I went, they would show up. I remember going to a dance that I didn't want to happen, okay, but they named it for me. So I said, the only people who aren't going to get invited to this dance are my friends, because, okay, and my name's on the damn thing, okay. So indeed, I decided I'm going. By the time I was on my way, okay, there were three cops there, and helping me off the parade when I had to get off to get to this dance, making sure that I got there safely and what have you. I mean, they were amazing, and they stayed that way. After the first time I got a big award in the parade, okay, they were committed to take me home, and you couldn't, where I live was all blocked off from cars and stuff. So they took me to a friend's house who had stuck an email to the whole world saying, I don't drink, if you want to come, okay, but, and I'm not going to the parade. My house is open, and it's just below where everything is cut off. Okay, come, okay, I have water in my house and nothing else. If you want to drink anything else, bring it with you. And that's Carla.
Yes, okay.
And that's the person who does my website now, too. Okay, but, and the cops were there. The cops, so the cops are driving me, and we're crossing, I don't know if you guys know, 6th Avenue, the other way around. We're west and crossing. We're finally going to cross 8th Avenue, 7th Avenue, 6th Avenue, and then get into her house. And at every corner, the traffic was terrible at that point from the parade throw out, and over. And they would
the
stop,
Pride Parade, yeah.
They would stop at the corner, and one cop would go forward and explain the importance of stopping traffic, and we would go through. Okay. We got there. They came with us up the thing, and they kept talking about a box that would be delivered to my house the next day. That box included New York Police Department hats and insignia. And I forget, like 10 different things, and a stack of them, and the box was marked for Edie Windsor and the Windsorettes.
Okay. I so want to be a Windsorette.
Yeah.
Please.
Stand in line.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
As the sun set on your issue of the gay marriage, have you found new causes or new interests, or is your work is done, you're like moving off into the sunset with gay issue, like what are her new battles that she has?
So do you feel like your work is done with sort of gay issues, marriage issues, and like what are your plans? Do you feel like you have things to?
I feel very strongly about the kids on the street, okay? That's a major problem. It's something, one, there are a lot of kids on the street. But it turns out something like 60% of them are gay kids who have been thrown out of their homes when they told their parents who they were. So I got involved with a number of the organizations. Then I discovered he was with Trevor. That didn't hurt, I tell you. Okay. But I've been to a number of meetings. I've been talking to people. I have my fantasy is I can't be that active anymore. I'm old and things are wrong with me. But my feeling was if I could make a coalition of the number, there's a number of groups only addressing kids, I guess up through age 20 or so, and that if we had a coalition where one who has 100 beds, okay, and one who has 2 beds only, okay, can refer to each other and stuff like that. And I think that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It could probably take another full year. But everybody I've talked to or every group that I've addressed, the person who's running it says, yes, help, let me know how I can help.
Right.
So I think we could do that without me getting overactive.
Maybe a couple of...
I want this lady right here.
Yeah, please.
I just wondered if you had any specific interactions with any of the judges, and if you have any memorable one that you wanted to share in terms of your exchange with each other.
So the question is, did Edie have any exchanges with the judges in the Supreme Court case?
Well, I have to tell you that, do you know what the Supreme Court looks like? Okay, there's a stage and all 9 guys are up there. The first thing after the stage are the lawyers who are arguing the case. Then there's a little space after which there's a whole area reserved for lawyers who are, okay, who are able to work in D.C. The next whole thing is just any other lawyers, okay? Then there is a long, okay, space maybe as wide as this thing for people to walk back and forth, and then we have the guest section. The first line in the guest section are guests of the judges, okay? The second line, okay, may be the plaintiffs. They may be, okay, and each lawyer who is arguing that day has a certain number of seats, okay? And the lines were horrendous, and I've learned since that the prices change, okay? But originally we had six seats, and I have a friend who is my health proxy and stuff, but she's also a co-trustee of my trust, and so if I can't continue, okay, it would be her job to take over. So I said I'd like her to have a seat, and that was no problem. She had except they took back two seats. So I paid $1,200 for my friend Karen to stand in line. Wow. I've learned since that
it's a racket.
As the time goes by, okay, they publish the cost, and if it's a thing, very popular thing, and the line is very long, okay, it costs more to get to get into that line.
That's democracy, folks.
Furthermore, no, wait, wow. Okay. The other thing is that there is a line, it's called the 3-minute line. Okay, and a lot of people do that to spend 3 minutes, okay, stand in that line and you get to spend 3 minutes inside the court where you can see what the court looks like, what the actions are and stuff like that. And my two kid cousins are there with their parents. And they had made a huge sign. And when they got up to the front of that, and they had been to the other cases, by the way, whenever there was court, their father brought them. Okay, and they got up there, and the guy said, "You can't take that sign in." So they said, "Well, could we leave it here?" He said, "No, you have to get rid of them." So they got rid of the signs, and the guy said, "You kids sit here." And then the parents sat where everybody else with 3 minutes sat. The kids got to sit through the rest of the thing. Their parents did not. They're waiting outside. Okay, there were some wonderful experiences in the process. The other thing is, people first said to me, "What was the most exciting thing about the day?" I was on the furthest most seat in our guest row, and Nancy Pelosi was on the rightmost seat, and Nancy Pelosi got up and walked over and kissed me on the cheek and said, "I'm very glad to meet you." I thought that was the highlight of the day. I did.
So you have no interaction with the judges whatsoever?
No, God, no. Right.
But, you know, I think it's interesting, the thing we talked about yesterday was I asked you the moment that you knew you won.
Oh, okay.
Right, that when you were in the courtroom.
Right,
and you
we
went.
Knew that Judge Kennedy would be the swing vote if we got it. And I couldn't tell. I couldn't tell from the questions. You really can't tell. Except one thing that happened is they stopped questioning Robbie early, which means that they ran out of questions for her. That's a very good sign. Okay. Usually it's the other way around. And the other thing is that suddenly I didn't hear what came first, okay, but I hear Judge Kennedy say, "What about 40,000 children in California?" And I thought, "Oh my God, we're going to win," okay, because apparently there's 40 or 48,000 kids.
Who are the kids of same-sex parents, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Okay. So that then I was pretty sure we were going to win. Mm. However, I got out there and the press was all over the place, and you're not allowed to stand on the steps. And I think they're changing that law now. As long as you're being interviewed by the press, you're all right. But you're on the side of the steps. But at the bottom of the steps is a world of people, like friends of mine from every organization. Had rallies, so there were like 1,000 people out there. Anyhow, at some point, I look up and I see the head of one of my kid cousins sticking out in the middle of these guys, and I said, "Oh, that's my family. Okay, I think you're done now." And there's all those people over there who came a long way to see me, and I took off. Okay, and the one of the lawyers, one of our three lawyers, and her spouse, okay, each grabbed my arm, because on the bottom step, there's a big rope after the bottom step with all the people, and I'm trying, there are pictures that look like a triumphant me, okay. What they are is me walking across this skinny one step, saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. Okay. Actually, Robbie handed me a sheet of paper as we were leaving the court, and it was single-spaced and full. And I said, and she told me that we were not going to do the press release there. We were going to Paul Weiss, where we would be taking phone calls and stuff. Only they changed their minds and they forgot to tell me. So she hands me this sheet of paper and I said, what am I supposed to do with this? And we're all the way on the way out. And she said, you're going to read it. And not a chance in hell. I leave three spaces between a line and the print is 24, you know, okay, for every speech. You know, there's no way I could do this. And I just crumpled it up. And when I first got before these guys, and I said, somebody gave me this piece of paper, but I don't know what it is, and I'm not going to read it, okay? And then I answered questions. But that piece of paper is in my hand. You can see it as I'm walking across the place. Anyhow, the police were chasing us because we're on the steps, okay? So these two lawyers who are holding me in, okay? And because they're sure I'm going to fall and break my neck and stuff, okay? Anyhow, we finally, and then suddenly my congressman appears on the steps. And I had one cop holding my shoulder, and none of my cops, okay? And I kept saying, that's my congressman, and walking. So I'm walking with his hand on my shoulder saying, that's my congressman. And we actually made it in one of the newspapers, hugging each other. Mm. Okay. And then the cops took me away.
Do you want to take a last question?
Yeah, sure. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you.
Tim?
The future's about the young people, Edie, and you mentioned that you and Thea cried only once when you lamented the loss of the actual accomplishments you could have made in the world if you didn't have to stay in the closet. What would you like to tell young people about being able to be who they truly are to the fullest extent that they can?
You're going to have to tell me.
So what would you like to say to young people
who,
just to encourage them to be who they are to the full extent that they can be?
It's hard to say, but I think my film helps it a lot. I talk to the kids. My last thing was at Live Out Loud with kids. But every year I do one or more, the groups who are giving me some kind of an award. And I'm talking to the kids then all the time. It's what it's about. And I think they get a lot from the whole experience. That we were able to change a major, law, for one, okay. On the other, I used to get, ACLU had me doing phone things for a while, just answering calls. And it was mostly young people. And people would say, should I be doing what you're doing? And I got famous for saying, I'm a lesbian, an out lesbian, who is suing the United States of America. Do I think you should do that? No.
Okay. On that note, I just want to say that one of the things that's really great, this book is so moving, and it's really like the blow-by-blow of the whole thing. But one of the things that I love about Roberta Kaplan is that she said this great thing, which is that there's no wrong time for justice.
Yeah.
And you are the living embodiment of that fact in our midst. And I'm so grateful personally to you, and I'm sure everybody here in this room is so grateful to you. So thank you so much.